All right, we're on with Andy Goldfein, founder of a little boutique shop you may have heard of once or twice called Aerostitch.
Doesn't ring any bells.
Oh, they're the maker of the Road Crafter suit, Darien jacket. No, never seen these? No.
No.
Pioneers in the world of high-vis.
Oh, so like Claire.
No, not like Claire. Andy, how's it going?
Great. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you guys tonight.
Oh, the pleasure's all ours.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for coming on.
I was just finishing up teaching a class a couple weekends ago, and my other instructor and I were looking at each other, and I'm like, man, we look like an Aerostitch, like, marketing brochure.
Well, you got the Falstaff, right?
I'm rocking the Falstaff and the gloves, and he's rocking a Road Crafter and the gloves and the boots and the whole nine yards. So,
while you're teaching?
Not while we're teaching.
Oh, okay.
I want to thank you guys for your business with us and for your orders, and let your audience know that there was no sponsorship involved. You paid your hard-earned money for them.
Yeah,
we sure did.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the great products. I mean, they make a real impact in people's lives.
Yeah,
so to speak,
or the impact on the city. So, okay. Just to start things out, what got you down this path of making the first Aerostitch suit? Because I'm totally picturing you like riding around Duluth in this really like dorky looking prototype suit with like duct tape and things on it.
The intersection or confluence of several different things at the same time in my life led to the founding of Aerostitch. And one area of my life wasn't going very well, and that was my employment with outside of before Aerostitch. I wasn't very happy with what I was doing. Another area was the availability of sewing, industrial sewing equipment, very inexpensive. At the time, 30 years ago, it was just when the sewing industry was leaving America for Asia. Mm-hmm. And factories were closing. Over 1 million garment workers have lost their jobs in the last 30 years. In America, this industry is gone almost. But the equipment that they worked on that wasn't auctioned and sent to Asia ended up with guys like me, and I ended up with 16 sewing machines that had formerly been used to build winter coats and snowmobile suits. Hmm.
And
a little bit of money that I had saved from working, and a little bit of money that I had been gifted as a child from grandparents and things like that, and an unhappiness with my existing employment situation and not knowing what to do with myself. My college degree is philosophy with a minor in English, and that's not a very employable.
Well, didn't they open that big philosophy plant in Duluth recently?
Yeah, Chapter 9 bankruptcy 3 months later. It was terrible.
But I bet they thought a lot about it.
They did. So that's how I ended up doing Aerostitch. The sewing equipment was not good for making t-shirts or lightweight clothing. Industrial sewing equipment is very specialized for what type of clothes are being made. So if you're making blue jeans, you have special machines for that. If you're making pajamas, you have special machines for that. If you're making winter coats, you have special for that. And I had equipment that could have made winter coats and snowmobile suits and life jackets and things like that. And I looked at it took about 2 years to figure out what to make. In my personal life, I was a motorcyclist, but a pretty casual one. I would go trail riding on weekends. I had done some AMA enduros for a couple of years and enjoyed playing around with dirt bikes. I also was getting to an age when it was in some of the circles of people that I was associating with, found it hard to believe that I hadn't grown up and started playing golf or tennis or some normal activity. And so I would run into, 10 years after high school, I was running, it's a small town, I'd run into somebody I'd been to high school with. And they'd say, well, gee, great to see you again. Are you still riding those motorcycles? And I'd go, yeah.
They're death machines.
Motorcycles.
Exactly. And I was, you know, I didn't quite know how to answer that question because in my generation, I think some of the people that knew me thought that was something you grew out of. And about the same time I got the sewing machines, I realized that I wasn't going to grow out of motorcycle riding ever, and that as long as I had the ability to ride, I would want to do that. instead of drive around in a car. And so I couldn't figure out how to make a better ski jacket or a better life jacket or better sailing foul weather gear or better anything that was already on the marketplace. And when I got the machines, I decided I would change my job. I took a 3-to-11 shift work job at a motel as a desk clerk, so that I had my days free to try and figure out a business plan.
And your evenings free to sit at a desk and be bored and figure out a business plan.
After the check-in rush, which was about three to seven or eight, then from the 7 or 8 p.m. to 11, when I got off, there was plenty of spare time at this motel. Had 96 units. It wasn't a very big place. So there was a lot of time with that job to play with the business plans. And I started wanting to ride to work, which was at that time, it was about a 6-mile commute. And I was wearing a uniform for that desk clerk job, a vest and a tie and a polyester suit coat. And I thought it would be very nice to have a coverall, like a snowmobile suit or like a rain suit. But I wanted crash protective armor, vents and reflective and all that stuff. And there wasn't anything like that on the market for motorcyclists. I had, as a kid, when I was young, starting riding, the motorcycle stores, shops were not like they are today in that they didn't have clothing, none of them. You'd go into a motorcycle dealer and they had exhaust pipes and handlebars and saddlebags and oil and all kinds of stuff in there, but no clothing. So when I was starting riding as a 16-year-old, I mail ordered for my first jacket, which was a wax cotton bell staff jacket. And I wore that like crazy until my mother wouldn't let me keep it in the house anymore.
Sounds like Tug.
No, my wife's told me I can't keep mine in the house.
So I was wanting to commute. And I didn't like using – I had a car or access to a car, and I really did not like that. I liked riding so much that I wanted to have a coverall that I could put on over this desk clerk uniform and ride – and then get out of the thing once I got there, not have to change into leathers or be stuck with unprotective jeans. And I was always – as an off-road enduro rider, I was wearing all kinds of armor to bash through the woods for a couple of years. And so I really didn't want to ride around on the street in just jeans and a sweatshirt, as stylish as that was at the time. And that is what guys like Steve McQueen wore, jeans and a sweatshirt. But I wanted something armored and that could get in and out of quick. And that's where the Aerostitch suit came from, all the intersection of all those ideas.
So back up a second. You just sort of took a leap of faith and bought all this sewing equipment without really a clear germ of an idea of what to do with it?
That's correct. But the sewing equipment, what was the excuse was that the sewing equipment was almost free. Industrial sewing machines today, like the kind we use, are $4,000, $5,000, $6,000. And at the time, you could buy them for $50.
Okay. Wow.
Similar ones of that era that were used once, $50 and $100. They were nothing.
So was Duluth, right?
Duluth, yeah.
Was Duluth a large textile place, textile center before that time, or?
Not particularly. The place that I got the 16 sewing machines from had about 100 sewing stations or workstations. There was a place when I was growing up here with about 1,000 garment workers. There was another one when I was a child here with about 300 garment workers. The majority, as I understand it, of the sewing industry was in the southeast part of the United States, North Carolina and Tennessee and South Carolina. That's where the big factories were.
What were you riding around on as for your work commute?
Well, for a while I was riding my enduro bike, which in those days, had only a lighting coil, no brake light, no mirror. It sounded almost like it had an expansion chamber the way I had it set up. It wasn't quite that loud, but pretty close. And I was worried about getting a ticket. A friend of mine had Airhead BMW, 1,000cc BMW, that he was making payments on, and he wanted to get out from under the payments. And he made me a good deal on the Airhead BMW. And so that was the turning point for me, is when I switched from owning only one motorcycle to owning two. And then I knew I was going to be in it for the rest of my life. So I was commuting on an Airhead BMW. And I liked the BMW. I sort of bought it blind. The last sort of really street legal bike I'd had was 15 years earlier, 10 years earlier, I had a series of little Hondas when I was 16, 17, 18 years old that were genuinely street legal. So then there was a long period when I had more quasi street legal dirt bike. And then, and I would run around and try to hide from the police, sort of, and
in a high vis suit.
You know, that was before Aerostitch. And then I got this BMW, and I was suddenly legit. I had a real license plate, a real horn, real brake light, real turn signals.
Ooh, well, hey, boy, I liked spoiled.
The BMW because at the time, the Japanese full size bikes did not have very long travel suspension. The BMW, of the 70s, this was a 1978 model, had almost dirt bike like suspension. It had pretty long travel, and the Japanese bikes of that era were much less capable on gravel roads, believe it or not, the street bikes. This was a pretty good bike on a gravel road. I was riding with what you'd call trials tires on this street bike, so I could handle gravel around here. Around Duluth in northern Wisconsin, northern Michigan, northern Minnesota, there's not a lot of viable agriculture, so you don't have a lot of farm roads. But there is forestry roads and logging roads, and there's lots of gravel roads. So if you want a street bike that can go anywhere, you need to be able to ride on a gravel road. And the BMW is pretty good at that with the right tires, even though it was a street bike.
Who got the second suit?
That's a great question. I don't know who got the second suit. I know who got the first one, but not the second one.
It wasn't you? Got the first one?
Yeah, my assumption was
you're like, here, try this on and tell me if you die.
I'm saying who paid for, who was the first paying customer. I don't know the second paying customer. I know the first one.
Well, who was there a second guinea pig?
Well, I was the guinea pig for all this stuff. The presumption from the beginning was not so much that I was going to make $1 million, but that if I liked whatever I made, I should make it for myself. And with good luck, other people might like it. Mm-hmm. So I thought that there might be people who wanted to commute like me and wanted this coverall. And I sort of had two scenarios or fantasies. One was that there would be just enough people who wanted something like this for their commuting so that I could employ one or two people to help me, and I could have a little basement business with my sewing machines, making one or two of these a week. And at the other extreme was the sort of Willy Wonka fantasy, where people would look at the Ford car in their garage, then they'd look at the riding suit, and they'd go, why am I driving this car? I have a riding suit now. I don't need to drive anymore ever. I've got this armored riding suit I can use instead. I can ride. And that I would be the next Henry Ford. And millions of people would jump out of their cars and buy motorcycles. That didn't happen, but
what actually happened? What was the initial kind of response to the suit and to the company?
Well, there were a few people who got it. I mean, who just drilled it, and they were very loyal and enthusiastic and encouraging. The people who wanted to commute got it. The Cycle magazine editors were, as a group, a few of them got it, but many, many of them did not understand what the suit was for till they had tried it. There was a very common experience early in the development of this I grew up in the junior high school and high school reading motorcycle magazines in study hall, and was very interested in all aspects of motorcycling. And when I got the thing ready to be produced, I put a suit in a box with a cover letter and to my favorite magazine editors. And I wrote them and said, "Dear so-and-so, encloses a new kind of rider's clothing. It's for this. This is what the intent is. I hope you'll give it a try. If it's the wrong size, I'll call you in a couple weeks and I can send you another size or we can figure it out." And I knew that if I was too, if I pestered them, they would just not be interested. So I felt I had to let them discover the suit themselves. And several of the sort of bigger at the time or more well-known magazine editors did sort of a W.C. Fields, go away from me, kid, you bother me kind of a thing at the back in that day. I remember calling one of them a couple weeks after I'd sent it, and the guy said, and I didn't know any of these people, and I've since become friends with some of them, but the guy said on this one particular case, he said, no, it's underneath the coat rack, it's still in its box, we don't have time to play with it, or something like that. And
could you send it back? I got a lot of material in that. Yeah.
But some of them did get it and wrote very, very nicely about it. One of the early supporters and who understood it was a guy named Stephen L. Thompson, Steve Thompson, and he's still a friend. The common experience with the writers who, including the Cycle magazine editors, most of which at the time worked in the Los Angeles area, the common experience was they would get into it and kind of size it up, move around in it a little bit, and then they'd go out on their bike and they'd get a few miles and they'd find themselves sort of giggling into their helmet. It was so much more of a you felt so protected and so comfortable compared to a leather suit for a racer. And I had leather pants and a leather jacket by this time. I used to call how they fit me and how you felt in them. I used to call that protective feeling of being in leathers the sausage effect. You felt like a Frankfurter in a casing, kind of. And in the road crafters, the early road crafters, it was a completely different feeling. And you felt secure and safe and comfortable and cool. And you had some control of your ventilation. There was none of this Frankfurter effect. If anything, it was a little more like today's Iron Man experience, where you put on this magic suit and you can do anything. And these guys would be going down the highway in the morning on their way to work, sort of giggling in their helmets because they knew something that nobody else knew. They had discovered a better way to dress for going from A to B to work. It was just a revelation to them. And that was a very, very common. At the time, Aerostitch was very, very small, and I was still answering the phone, every phone call, and packing every suit and doing all the odd jobs that take a small business to start. And I got lots of compliments from guys who tried them on skeptically, got 5 miles, and went, "Holy smokes, this is really going to change my life."
I never pretend I'm a spaceman when I'm wearing a suit.
Never.
Never.
No, sir.
No.
No.
So interesting thing about that. So the road crafter is kind of, the no bullshit. I'm really protected. I'm taking this very seriously kind of suit, which is, let's admit it, not the most fashionable, but that's because you're looking at it from the outside and it's meant to be looked at from the inside. The interesting thing I see going on is it seems like your big growth area these days isn't actually in the no bullshit suit. You're kind of, I don't know what to call it, the compromise riding gear, the Darien Lights, the Falstaffs, the, giving up a little protection for a little more something else.
This year we made a lot of changes in our product line. The Roadcrafter that everybody's familiar with, who knows about Aerostitch products, is technically the Roadcrafter 2. We made about 50 to 100 of a slightly different looking Roadcrafter right at the very beginning of the company. And then we figured out how to seal the stitched seams to help it be a little more water resistant. Mm-hmm. And so we made for about 26 or 7 or 8 years the Roadcrafter 2. And after the first year or two, we stopped calling it the 2, and it just became the Roadcrafter. And we refined it and refined it and refined it until this past year. And many riders have over the year, they last somewhere between 5 and 15 years, depending on how much one rides. And some of our customers are on their third or fourth one. And this year we renamed the Roadcrafter the Roadcrafter Classic, and we introduced an all new suit called the R3, which stands for Roadcrafter 3. And the R3 looks the same on the outside as the Roadcrafter people are familiar with. But on the inside, it's made more like a Darien. That is to say, there's no hung lining. When you buy a winter coat or a men's blazer or sport coat, you have a a separate lining that hangs on the inside. But in our Darien garments, the armor is just adhered to the backside of the single layer of fabric in individual bags with hook and loop. And it makes a structurally lighter garment, and one that dries more quickly, and one that ventilates better, and one that has no hidden anything between the inner and outer lining. It's a really honest garment, the Darians. And because of how they're constructed, they're a little more waterproof than the Road Crafter. And so the R3 is something that is brand new this year. It looks like a Road Crafter, but it's made like a Darien. And that's still the core of our business. And what you're asking about is, are there some tangents that we've gone out on to expand our range and our market? The answer is yes. The first one, about, I would say, 5 or 6 years after the Road Crafter, people were buying the Road Crafters and they weren't using them the way I expected them to use them to ride to work. They were using them for touring and traveling and recreational riding, mm-hmm. sport riding. And because they were better than leather clothing in a lot of ways. We were dumb in some ways. The type of armor we used, which is we call TF 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 now, had a way of stiffening. It was a radical new material at the time. And we had no idea that it was actually a better energy-absorbing, impact-absorbing material than what guys like Kenny Roberts and Freddie Spencer were wearing, the pro riders. We had a more protective impact pad than the pro riders were wearing at the time, and we had no idea. But so recreational riders were, which is 99% of riders in America, were buying the suits for recreational riding of one description or one sort or another. Mm-hmm. And the Road Crafter was intended for commuting in my mind. And so about 5 years later, we developed a new jacket called the Darien jacket, which had no separate hung lining, and which was my idea of what today would be called an adventure riding jacket. It had armor, it had vents, it was very much more waterproof by design than the Road Crafter. It wasn't intended just to get somebody from A to B across a 10-minute commute or a 20-minute commute. It was intended to be a modern, updated version of a barber or bell staff jacket. And that was for traveling and touring and all-day riding in my mind, adventure riding also, and even some enduro and off-road riding. I was going to take it out to show the Cycle Magazine editors it, this suit, this jacket. This is one of my favorite stories. I haven't told this in a long time. We had the Darien jacket all worked out as a sort of a touring, traveling, armored, vented, wonderful jacket. And the plan was for me to ride out to California. And I'd been there a couple of times previously to meet some of the Cycle Magazine editors and tell them about the Road Crafter. So I was going to go out there and do that with the Darien. And I thought I was, in my mind, was going to use the pants from a Road Crafter as my riding pants. And I put the two on, the Darien jacket and the Road Crafter pants, and I realized that they really didn't go together very well. The Road Crafter pants have a full lining. They have a ballistics area on the knee. They just are completely different. So at the very last minute, like 5 days before I was scheduled to leave on this ride to California, I worked with our pattern maker, and we copied a pair of Levi's jeans and put side zippers on and threw together these Darien pants so that I could start to wear underneath this new jacket that we'd worked for a year on. I got out to California and I showed the jacket and everything was good. And on the way back, there was a BMW motorcycle rally, I think by the San Diego BMW Club on the road that goes up to Mount Palomar.
Okay.
And I can't remember, maybe it was called the Oktoberfest or something like that. And I remember thinking, I'll go there and I'll stop and I'll camp for a night on my way home as long as I'm in California, get a rally pin. And if you've ever been to a BMW or many of the destination brand marquee rallies, they're sort of like railbirds. The other people who are attending the rallies often sort of hang out at the registration area to watch the parade of people coming and registering at the rallies. Like they're like railbirds, mm-hmm. like at a racetrack, a horse racing track. And they're sort of watching the bikes come and go. And so I pull into the rally registration area for the Oktoberfest at the San Diego Club wearing this brand new Darien jacket that's just been the result of all this work that I just shown the Cycle magazine editors. And I put the bike on the stand and lay the jacket over the saddle. Like 30 people are sort of hanging out, standing around, watching me and the others who are coming and going. And I walk over to the card table in the little tent to pay my money and get a place to camp. And about in the space of the 10 feet or 20 feet walk, three people came up to me and said, "Where'd you get those pants?" And so when I got back to Minnesota, I realized we had to make the pants too.
Could have been worse. They could have been like, "How far do you think you're going to get in those pants?"
Nobody asked about the jacket. So maybe,
Darien outfit.
It's the Darien outfit is our attempt at building a modern traveler's or enduro or off-road or adventure or touring suit. When you're riding intra-city, short hop rides, riding to work, riding for errands, whatever, the cool thing about a one-piece coverall and about the Aerostitch one-piece coverall is it's sort of an all-in-one protection system. Hangs on a nail in your garage or wherever. You jump into it, and if you're wearing ankle-high boots and you've got a pair of gloves and a helmet, you're done. You can go, ride 10 minutes, get to work, ride 20 minutes to the grocery store, wherever you go. If you don't mind looking like a Power Ranger, it's the simplest, fastest, easiest way to incorporate riding into your everyday routines. But when you're traveling, it's a great all-in-one system. But when you're traveling, it's really nice to have a two-piece outfit because you're stopping for lunch. You want to take off your jacket. Or you're sort of hanging out your pattern. If you're riding for 2 hours or 3 hours on a Saturday, it's nice to have a two-piece suit because you can take the jacket off when you stop. And you're still in pants. You're not sort of stuck in the suit all day. Having said that, I must add one more little thing, which is I've ridden all over the country in a one-piece roadcrafter, and it works just fine. Lots and lots of people do that. But it's very, very nice to have a two-piece Darien or Falstaff outfit when you're on the bike for more than 15 or 20 minutes at a time. The one-piece is, in my opinion, a great all-in-one system for short hop, everyday riding. And the two-piece is what I choose when I'm going for a half a day or longer on the bike.
That is really interesting you say that, because for the longest time, I think, in the internet web mind, the roadcrafter is sort of like the gold standard for touring.
Yeah, but it's like he said. I mean, look at me now. I specifically went to great lengths to be able to wear my – because after a year and a half in the fall stuff, I'm like, I will not let go of this jacket.
Yeah.
I do with cold, dead hands.
Yeah.
I went to great lengths to make sure I had some pants I could wear with it for the trip
took.
Because it really is, like he says, nice. You drop the coat and go do your thing.
Yeah, you buy gas or you sit down and have a meal or whatever. Set up your tent site, campsite or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Now, am I correct in thinking that you actually handmade the early suits?
You are not correct.
Okay.
I was very fortunate to be able to find some of the garment workers from these closed factories.
And them down.
Some of these people had years and years. They had careers that was really kind of sad. There was I had probably I don't remember the exact numbers, but probably peaked at maybe 10 or 15 people who were in their 40s and 50s who had put in 10, 15, 20 years working in the garment business, sewing clothes, making stuff, who suddenly didn't have an industry to go to. And so there was – I would run a help wanted ad for sewers or for pattern making or whatever, and I would get plenty of applicants for the first 10 years of Aerostitch or 15 years of Aerostitch. These people lost their occupation as it went to Asia. They were good people.
That's – wow, okay.
So how many people does Aerostitch employ today?
It varies seasonally, but – I think I don't even know anymore.
he has people for that.
he sees the Oompa Loompas dancing around. Yeah, whatever.
We're we're really a small company. We're in the same building where we started.
I have to say I was a little disappointed by the building because I went there and I made my wife stop in Duluth on a trip and she was like, oh God. And I was totally imagining I would go inside and it would be like Willy Wonka. It turns out they're just making suits. Although the little bike on the playground bouncy spring was pretty cool.
We had a very funny email, almost the same. Some guy with I think one of the BMW sub-chapter clubs for one of their most luxurious touring bikes. And I don't know the nomenclature, but like the sub-chapter for the six-cylinder RT touring bike or whatever it was, were pretty well-to-do, sophisticated people. And the guy posted to his online forum. He said, yeah, I went to Duluth. I'm paraphrasing, not quoting here. He says, yeah, I went to Duluth. And I looked all over, and I drove back and forth three times, and that couldn't. And said to myself, mm-hmm. This guy's writing this out to his form. He says, I rode back and forth in front of the place three or four times, and said that couldn't be Aerostitch. That looks like crap.
it's this little brick building with a sign the size of like a license plate, and a door with no window, and just inside.
It was very gratifying. He continued that to his forum post. He said, but I went inside and they had what I wanted and they had good customer service and it was all good. But we got a kick out of that.
So now the one last question about the company. Now your competition has kind of stepped up their game lately. I mean, first, you know, you were making the suits and nobody else really had the onesies. Now the onesies are, you know, everybody's got one that they're throwing around. You know, they have the guy making Adventure Face in it.
Yeah, and there's the twosies too. I mean, Touratech's mm-hmm. coming out, Ruka's... You know, Taze. I mean, there's a lot of names in this field now.
So what are you guys doing to kind of set yourselves apart from them? Or do you feel like you need to? Or
why Stitch, Andy? Why Stitch?
The first and reason is that I still think it's a better product at the end of the day. And I can ground that on several very, very subjective levels. The first level is that most of the other kinds of similar gear, and there's lots and lots of good gear out there besides Aerostitch now. When you walk into a cycle shop today, it looks like a clothing store. Mm-hmm. It doesn't look like the cycle
shop. Especially if you walk into a Harley Davidson.
they all look like clothing stores. And the reason, if you walk into any sporting goods store, like a ski shop or a running store or a motorcycle store, all these places that cater to the specialized sports, look like clothing stores. And the reason they all do is because that's where the money is made. The running store makes all their money on clothing. The ski shop doesn't make money on ski boots and skis.
Hard they
make
money.
Hard goods suck. And so the money is made at motorcycle shops on the clothing now. And it's because of the wage differentials and all kinds of consequences of global free trade, which is good for Americans in a lot of ways and good for the world in a lot of ways. But the reason that the clothes are in all of the specialty sports stores is because it's very profitable. What they can't really do that we can do at Aerostitch is a retail motorcycle store needs to show a lot of styles. So they like to have hanging on the rack 30 styles, women's, men's, short, long, different designs and patterns. But usually there's not as much depth of fitting. In a road craft, we only make 3-4 styles, but we make like 30 sizes in every style. So and the jump between a small and a medium and a large, that's like 3 of our sizes. So if you really want a good fit, when people go shopping for shoes, they don't buy a size medium shoe. They buy a 9.5 or a 10 or an 11 or a 9.5D even or a C or a B. When you ask a woman what her favorite pair of shoes is, and she might have 50 pairs of shoes, she always will tell you that it's this or that pair that fits the best. So one of the things that we specialize in is providing a great fit, and we're very good at that.
And available right now somewhere on a rack are the size 48 Falstaff pants that didn't fit me because I have stubby legs.
Right. Set back. Well, for that, in that case, if everything else fits, we actually have alterations available, and we can build a pair with the knee bend slightly higher or the hem slightly longer. We do not build fully custom garments like race leathers, but we alter these off the rack sizes, and 80 or 90% of the people fit the off the rack sizes and just get a better fit than small, medium, and large. That's something that differentiates us from most of the other garments. Are designed for a supply chain and for a method of merchandising that relies on lots of styles and not as many sizes. So that's a big differentiator. Another differentiator is we're the original on a lot of these products. And the original is in some ways, usually, and I'm going to speak just in generalities here, not about Aerostitch specifically, but when you look at like blue jeans, for example, the original blue jeans like Wranglers or Lee's or Levi's are usually they're a great product. And the people who come later with designer jeans and with decorative stitching or whatever gimmick they have, they're usually not improving on the basic core Levi 501 or Wrangler or whatever. And there's some of that aspect going on in the motorcycle sportswear right now. There's an awful lot of garments that say, if this guy has five pockets on his, we'll put six on ours and it'll be better. And it usually isn't because the pockets then are too small to use or they're not in the right place or whatever. We spent a lot of time refining, designing, and figuring out our version of the Levi 501. So in the case of the Darien jacket or the Darien pants or the Falstaff or the Roadcrafter or the R3 – we set out to make fundamental pieces of equipment that work, and we didn't look very hard, and we still don't look very hard at what anybody else is doing. There's an awful lot of overcomplicated, overstyled stuff out there that is good stuff, but it's just not the. It's just in some ways functionally a little not as good. I don't know how to say this without sounding.
You can say it sucks. It's okay.
It doesn't suck. It's good stuff. But sometimes basic 501 Levi's are the best jean, and you don't need a designer jeans with embroidery here and decorative sewing there and whatnot.
Because sometimes, those suck.
Sometimes you just need a basic pair of blue jeans or a basic pair of whatever.
Yeah. This for the man who makes a jacket with so many pockets, I routinely lose crap in it.
you need the.
Actually, I just found a new pocket yesterday.
They're functional pockets, Todd.
Well,
I need like a little beeper that tells me what pocket my crap is in. Oh, it's in the there. It is.
If you go to the Aerostitch website and you type in the word walnut in the search field, all of the fake items that we've ever produced to parody real products come up on our website, and one of them is a GPS for your stuff to help you find your stuff.
That's not fake anymore. You can buy that stuff for your keys.
when we started, the basic standard jackets were like what we would call a zipper jacket or a biker jacket with all the zippers on and a Fonzie jacket. Mm-hmm. And compared to that kind of gear 30 years ago, Aerostitch suits, Roadcrafter suits were extremely complex for that era. At that time, nobody had removable armor. You bought a leather jacket and the armor was sewn right in. It was a rubber pad or a felt pad. And there was a lot of different thought put into the vents and the pockets and the zippers to try and make this a great piece of equipment, this early Roadcrafter, and the same with the Darien gear. Today, my personal view is that some of the newer gear has complexity for the sake of complexity, that it isn't really better. And I particularly am proud of not having linings in our R3 and in our Darien gear. I believe that taking the lining out and making it more like a rain suit out of a heavy fabric with armor that hook and loop attaches to the back side of it gives you something that's lighter and that flows air better, that dries more quickly if it does get wet, that's easier to field repair. And everybody else has these complicated liners, some zip in, some are made of mesh, but it's just more complexity. It's not necessarily better.
That weirdly makes me think of the jacket I had before the Falstaff, which looks like it, despite not being waxed cotton, but has vents all over it, except the two big armpit vents and one big vent in the back of the Falstaff end up flowing better than all the neat little weird ram air shoulder and elbow.
Mm-hmm. So I guess to summarize, there are three things. One, we have a lot more sizes usually than the similar jackets. Two, these are really long-term, fundamental, refined, basic pieces of equipment. Which we haven't touched on, there is some product support available here that it's hard to duplicate from Asia. We have a sewing factory, so we can alter and we can fix a zipper after 5 years with breaks or 10 years of breaks.
And you're going to make the Falstaff pants in shorts soon.
We do make Falstaff pants now.
The pants in short. Andy. Make short Falstaff pants for stubby guys.
Do you hear that, Tom?
Right now they're in regulars and longs, I think only. And you're right. We need to add those.
God is a short person, Andy.
I know. He rides a Trail 92, a yellow one. He didn't like the 110s, I don't think.
No, that was too much. He was like, screw that.
You know, as surprising as it might sound, Andy has another passion when it comes to motorcycling.
Oh.
It is not just making the Motorcycle Nation look like a bunch of spacemen.
Well, actually, you bring it up. It came up just in him talking about motorcycling. You're big on the motorcycle commuting thing, huh, Andy?
Yes, I am.
So do you, how many days a year can you pull off in Duluth commuting on a motorcycle?
You can, it depends on how hard you want to work.
Because I've been to Duluth and wintered it long.
Well, you've seen the road crafter, right?
Good point.
We all know fair weather riders who consider it an accomplishment to ride into work 2 or 3 days a year.
Mm. Yep. They're the ones who park badly.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And usually they ride not so well either.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
One of the cool things about riding is that your moves and your situational awareness and your everything becomes so much, just putting on your helmet becomes easier if you do it every day. Mm-hmm. You know how to manipulate the latch or the double D-rings or where to lay your gloves when you stop the bike to go put something in the mailbox.
Remember to put the kickstand down.
And then you drop them anyway.
Well, things become very automatic when you start riding a lot. Mm-hmm. And you get very fluid and very smooth, very fluent. And when you don't ride very much, everything. Haven't you ever taken a motorcycle trip and the first day is terrible and then by the second or third day things start to fall into place and everything gets really easy and you just don't – and when you're all done with the trip 5 days later, a week later, you come home and you just don't want to stop.
Yeah, that's true for everyone that does not have to take a trip with me.
Chuck doesn't have that. You know that effect where your luggage suddenly gets easier to pack a few days in? Chuck, yep, for some reason, doesn't have that.
My luggage grows. And my luck grows steadily worse.
Well.
But I still love it.
But yeah, so Ride to Work Day is coming up.
Yeah, so what we're trying to get around to here is Ride to Work Day.
As we dance around the topic.
June 16th, right?
Is this coming Monday?
This coming Monday.
I plan to ride to work that day.
The third Monday of every June. It's an annual event.
It is.
And this is like one of your big cause to get more people to just use the bike.
It's not just a toy.
As a tool, not just a toy.
I think the future of motorcycling in advanced and wealthy countries depends on more riders using them this way.
Mm-hmm.
If they're just toys, it's pretty easy for the mainstream of society and government to marginalize them more and more.
And for that Mustang guy to park in the motorcycle parking spot, that bastard. Sorry. Go on.
I believe it's a social good. I believe that riding regularly helps balance you and clarifies you. It helps your thinking. It helps your physiology and your neurology and your psychology and all the ologies. It makes you a better person. And I think that leading from that directly is that if anything that you do that makes you a better person and anything that society encourages that makes people helps build a better society, helps build a better civilization. And I think that spending all your time commuting in cars and depending on cars has sort of the opposite effect.
It's confining. It's like being in a cage.
One analogy that I can't back this up with any evidence, but one analogy is like going everywhere in a car is like eating junk food, and going everywhere on a bike that you can is like eating wholesome, healthy, organic, raw, real food. We all love hot dogs and ice cream and cotton candy. I love those things too. But it's much better for you to eat whole grains and asparagus and carrots and all that sort of thing. And if you get those things that are really fresh, they're actually pretty sweet. And you learn from regular riding to really appreciate the sweetness of the experience of riding. And it's good for you. And I'll extend one more piece. I think that the success that the Asian economies and societies have had since World War II partly comes from the idea that so many of the people over there went to their schools and their workplaces for two or three generations on bicycles and on small motorcycles because they didn't have cars. And so when they got to their schoolhouse or when they got to their job site, they were sharp, they were clear, they were well-adjusted, and they were ready to work because that's how they got to work. And here in America, people sit in their cars listening to Rush Limbaugh or the radio of some sort, and they get to work and they get to their school and they're not as clear and they're not as sharp and they're not as ready to go. So I really believe it's a social good. That's the term that I read somewhere about something, and I think it applies perfectly to riding a motorcycle. It's a social good. We built over the last 100 years all over the world in advanced and wealthy countries an infrastructure that's a sprawled out, convenient infrastructure, and many people who don't live in cities want to raise their kids so they have a nice backyard to play in and a nice suburban safe place. But if they work in a city and live and raise their families outside of the city, they can't get from A to B unless they use a car or a motorcycle. And they can't use a bicycle for that. You can inside of a city, because it's dense, get away with a bicycle for many commutes, but for many, many people, because of the way the world is built, because of the way we built our homes and our businesses and our streets and highways, we can't get from A to B on a bicycle because the distances are too far. And so the natural solution to being sharp and clear and healthy in your life is, when you can't use a bicycle or walk, is to use a motorcycle. That's the best of both worlds. It has the range and speed of a car with the clarifying and healthifying effect of a bicycle. Everything except the aerobic piece that a bicycle gives you.
And depending on how bad your ergos are, it could be a little aerobic. Or how far you have to push your Buell, right, Chuck?
Shut up.
My brother-in-law has a Buell.
They're I'm sorry.
Great. They're great. They're great. They're great, Todd.
Does yours have a fuel tank frame or a tubular frame?
It's a fuel tank frame.
Fuel tank frame?
Mm-hmm. It's a 2008 Ulysses.
That's what my brother-in-law has. Exactly the same bike.
Does he like it?
He does. He's been all over the country. I think he must have maybe 40,000 miles on his now.
See? They run. They're fine. People like them.
All right.
I'll kill you.
But do you take the Buell to work?
I do. Actually, it's easier for me to take the Buell to work than it is to take the Euro.
Mm-hmm. I have a Buell question because I've ridden his Buell a few times and been around it. My question with the fuel tank frame Buells, I don't understand. The piece that bothers me isn't really how they ride or how durable or any of that stuff. The piece that bothers me is when I stop the bike.
Oh, the air conditioner.
The fan comes on every time.
That's the air conditioner.
Right, and I hate that. When I stop the bike, I want to just have it be quiet.
Well, it is a Harley motor. It's an air-cooled Harley motor. And
the advice I've got is, it happens so often you won't even notice after a while.
It gets to be a joke with the Buell riders. And when you go walking away, someone will stop you and be like, hey, your bike's on. No, that's the air conditioner. It's fine. Leave it alone.
It was quite disconcerting the first few times I was around.
You're stop, like searching the bike.
Stop, what? I want to turn off.
Yeah, that's just sort of how the motor goes with that bike.
So do you ride to work every day you possibly can?
No, I don't. My commute is 3 miles here, and I try to, in the winter time, I like to walk it. It takes an hour. Mm-hmm. When it's really cold and when it's really snowy. it's a nice walk, and everybody else is indoors, so you own the walk. You're all alone once it's really cold, once it's 10 degrees or something like that. It's a nice walk. And in the summer, I either will rollerblade or bicycle to work. Which when it's nice. It's very nice. And then I will motorcycle on the days that I – either they're one of two things. Either I have a range of errands beyond what I want to do on the bicycle. Like, so if I – on a day that I know that I have to go to the pet store and get dog food or something, I'll take the motorcycle to work because I know that I have that errand and I can accomplish it with the motorcycle, and I can't easily with the bicycle. Or this is – to me, there's an irony in what I'm about to tell you. One of my favorite times to use the motorcycle is when the weather's bad, when it's really windy and I don't want to push the bicycle through the wind, mm-hmm. or when it's raining and cold and crappy in the summer. I love taking the motorcycle because being on a bicycle in those conditions is even less fun than it is on a motorcycle. And I don't have an aerostitch suit that works on a bicycle. I do for the motorcycle. So I jump into the aerostitch suit when it's raining out and ride to – instead of most riders, when the rain comes, put their bike away. For me, the riding the motorcycle is the rain day choice, but I don't bicycle.
The motorcycle is your car.
Yes. Unless I have something really too large to haul in it, or if I have to go pick somebody up at the airport, I take a car, stuff like that.
So are you going to be riding the motorcycle Monday?
Yes, I will.
Okay.
I'm guessing I probably ride the bicycle about 100 days a year and the motorcycle about 100.
What is the motorcycle? What's the motorcycle now?
Right now it's a DRZ 400.
Ooh, fun.
Oh. It's a Suzuki dual sport on-off-road bike.
That is fun.
Mm-hmm. It's an older one. It's a 10-year-old one. It's pretty stock, but it works good. It's an easy bike to deal with in the city.
I park next to one of those at work. I look like a mama duck next to it.
Well, yeah, with the Strom, yeah, I imagine.
It's important, I think, for riders to try and fit the bike to their application. In a town like Duluth, where it's only 85,000 people, you know, riding a Goldwing would make – to commute 3 miles on a Goldwing would make no sense. But a 225 dual sport bike, or the DRZ 400, or a XR650L or something, or KLR, those work great in this city, in this environment, in this situation. On the other hand, if you're in Chicago and you're riding 40 miles every day, you might as well have a Goldwing or something like that for that kind of a commute. So it's – that we're very lucky as riders that we have – there's more variety amongst motorcycles in weight and performance capabilities than there is among – you look at the smallest car like a Fiat and the biggest SUV like an Escalade or something like that. They're still more alike than the range of little motorcycles to big, I think. There's much more variety and diversity in motorcycles.
Those cars are soul-killing.
Yes.
They hold them down
pretty much.
On the other hand, also when it's expensive. Really cold and you got to go long distance, they're great.
I call those the drop me off at work honey uh-huh. days. It's a name I've come up with.
Used to be you could just ride to Euro.
Yeah.
There's people in Minnesota, I know one, that uses a Euro all year round in the winter. And for whatever reason, those Russian motorcycles seem to like to start in really cold weather.
Oh, they love the cold. Oh, they love it. Mine love that.
I can't believe that they start, but this guy starts his at 10 degrees below zero outdoors.
Oh, much better than when it's hot.
But that's where they're from.
So now... Oh, much better than when it's hot.
But that's where they're from.
So now, getting the ride to work day thing going, I assume people need to be hollering at people in their own office to be riding to work about this, huh? Do you have materials or posters they can stick up or...
There is. If they go to the Ride to Work website, there's all kinds of free downloadable, printoutable stuff. There's also a merchandise section. It's a little late to buy and order some stickers or anything, but you can print out facsimiles. Some companies that have really large pools of employees, you know, where if you work at a place where there's 1,500 or 2,500 people at the same job building, often in those kinds of places, even in places with 200 employees, if there's 10 people riding, they'll get together and they'll do a lunch or a breakfast or something, and to recognize it. And that you can download little stickers that are Avery labels that go on, that you can stick on your shirt, that like those I voted stickers from, you know, that you can stick it on your shirt. It says, I rode today. Ask me why, or ask me about it.
You know what really else works for getting that kind of visibility at work?
Mm-hmm.
Burnouts in the lobby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
and we broke it.
He's like, is he serious? Does he work at a prison?
That's why. Well.
Or that, or he's like, yeah, that, I do that.
We're still cleaning the floor from last year at Aristotle's.
I think there's some pretty fun online viral videos of guys who are doing like indoor burnouts. You can, I think you can Google that and some YouTube videos will come
He's
up.
Heard that. He's
I
heard.
Think the picture of my Strom parked in my cube pops up every once in a while. It was snowing outside. I need a place to put it.
I wonder if I can get the Buell into my cube.
All right. So make sure you check out, Ride to Work. What's the website?
We'll have the,
RideToWork.org.
We'll have the links on in our show notes. We'll have the links, of course, to Aerostitch, because people have never heard of it, I'm sure.
No. Certainly not from us.
It doesn't matter what you ride or what your commute or what, even on Ride to Work Day, if you work out of your house or if you're unemployed or whatever, it's very important to go for a ride and get as many motorcycles out on that day as possible. It's really designed as a media event. If you want to organize two or three people, you call your local radio station or your local news station. Motorcycling is sort of a colorful, high-profile activity, and this is an opportunity to tell a story about motorcycling that's very positive to the local reporter who's doing the AM drive time show on a radio or television station.
It did strike me as being sort of activism when I was just reading the descriptions and the background on the Ride to Work Day webpage. It felt very much like sort of an activist.
There's no membership, there's no dues. The idea is just to get out there and do it and
be visible.
If you really want to do something nice, you call local media and tell them, "Have you heard of Ride to Work Day?" And then you can go to the website and quote some of the reasons why motorcycles are a social good, and oftentimes the local TV station will send a reporter with a camera to interview you, and you can tell a good story about motorcycling.
Actually, I had a question about that. I was reading through the social good stuff, and one of the things that occurred to me, because you were talking about gas usage and traffic density, but on the other side of that coin, it's coming clear more and more that motorcycles tend to be grosser polluters than cars.
Pound for pound.
Yeah.
We have outsourced the regulation of emissions for vehicles to our government, and we have told them to take care of us. And they set the standards for the different kinds of vehicles in our best interest. And the automakers and the motorcycle makers comply if they want to sell their mm-hmm. vehicles to us. And if we want stiffer emissions regulations for bikes, all we have to do is tell our legislators that that's what we want. But it's our responsibility ends at voting on that issue, and riding what we have. Now the modern motorcycles, the bigger ones anyway, do, and even some of the smaller ones come with fuel injection now and catalytic converters. The newest, latest little Hondas, they've introduced a whole bunch of new, really easy to ride, medium and little sized bikes in the last 2 years. And they all have ABS, and they all have catalytic converters, and they all have fuel injection, and they're cheap. They're relatively cheap. These aren't $18,000 or $20,000 bikes. These are their $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 models. And if you spreadsheet out the fuel economy and the math for insurance, you can actually make the payments and come out a few hundred dollars a year ahead if you ride a couple hundred days. If you ride 150 or 200 days a year, and you put a couple thousand dollars into helmets, boots, gloves, and riding suits, you end up saving money over even a small car if you use the bike for your transportation. So it can be done.
So you're saying at this point you feel it outweighs one side of that scale outweighs the other pretty clearly.
I think so. You know, you can buy environmentally sound motorcycles according to what the regulations are, and you can even buy bikes that exceed the regulations by a significant amount. You can also buy some bikes that are pretty dirty still. The 50cc Chinese scooters that are sold at hardware stores and stuff, those two-cycle engines, those are terrible. But a you know, a late model BMW with a catalytic converter is about the same as their cars, I think. I'm not sure I have the facts right, but.
Well, they are getting, I mean, California in particular is getting tougher on emissions, like in 2015, 16. That's one of the drivers that Ural mm-hmm. switched over to fuel injection for 2014 mm-hmm. because the emission regulations tightening up.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. Cool.
Cool. Andy, thanks so much for being on with us tonight.
Well, thank you guys very much. It's my pleasure, Chuck. Thank you very much
and
for this opportunity.
You're welcome, Andy. You said thank you to me.
Yeah.
Because you're a jerk.
Yeah. I'm an Aristich customer.
Thank you guys very much.
Make the whole step pants in short.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Make the pants short.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye, Andy.
Bye. Bye for now.
Think he's going to make the Falstaff pants in short?
No.
I don't think he's biting. I don't think he's taking the hook. Man. Man. And that's all we got time for this week. Until next time, I'm Todd.
No, you're Doctor Who!
Ride safe, everyone.
We'll see you next week.
Or the previous week.
If you listen to us on iTunes, please write a review for us so that we can get some more exposure and hits. Thanks.
If you like this podcast, you can find more like it at wheelnerds.com. This has been a Wheel Nerds production, all rights reserved. Readings from other sources are the property of their respective owners and are used with satirical intent.